the film with three brains. It's 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 the film with three brains.
Oh my God, you guys are freaks.
Hello and welcome to the film with three brains. This is Sean in Chicago.
This is Cohen in Maplewood, New Jersey.
That's Sam in San Francisco.
Present and accounted for. Good to hear. We are going to do the movie Witness, starring Harrison Ford, directed by Peter Weir, 1985 thriller. I didn't mention crime when I talked about genres, but it's a crime thriller for sure.
Yeah.
And it's pretty...
They would call it... you'd also maybe call it neo-noir.
Yeah. I wouldn't have... That didn't come to mind right away, but yeah, action, thriller, suspense, drama. It's got it all.
It's also a fish out of water story.
Oh, yeah.
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 Which I really like about it.
Yeah. It's also hilarious.
I am willing to bet you cannot Google hilarious in this movie and find a real review that shows that those two words.
Yeah, I don't think anyone's ever going to be like, oh my God, I laughed my ass off through Witness.
Rolling in the aisles.
Listeners, have you not seen it? It's not funny.
No, don't be confused.
You want to say a quick synopsis?
Who's got a good synopsis? I don't really have one. I will say, wait, let me just start.
Is this your pick?
It is. Yeah. It is a great, you know, like the MacGuffin is titular, you know, I mean, it's
titular.
Yeah. I like that word. Yeah. I mean, like, I love that it's a one word title and it pretty much tells you a lot of what you need to know about this movie.
Yeah.
But there are other things.
Do you guys see what it was, read about what it was originally called?
Oh, no. What was it?
The original title when it was written was called Called Home, which is what is a euphemism the Amish use for dying, for passing away.
Oh.
And the producers decided to change it because it seemed like kind of a downer.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the funeral is not a huge, I mean, it's a good setup, but. It's not really about the funeral at all.
Right, right.
All right, well, synopsis?
Yeah, if no one else wants to jump in, I'll get whack. Harrison Ford is a detective in Philadelphia, and he meets an Amish boy that witnesses a murder and tries to help, wants his help, and they form a bond, but shit goes haywire, and they have to hide, and the best place to hide is in the middle of nowhere with the Amish community. That's pretty ham-handed. Anyone else want to try?
No, I mean, that's good. It. I mean, I think the thing that makes it fun is that that Harrison Ford's hiding from the very people he works with, because the kid points out that one of the cops is a bad cop. And actually, one of the cops that he points out is Danny Glover, who I can't remember. I mean, Danny Glover's been like 8,000 movies, but when has Danny Glover been a bad guy?
Yeah.
Anybody see that movie Switchback?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Okay, I don't think
that. And also, wasn't he? Oh, no, sorry. I was going to say Silverado, but he was a good guy. It was Jeff Goldblum who was a bad guy.
Yeah. So, yeah, I was just like, oh, Danny Glover's the bad guy.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, yeah, he's played good cop, bad cop.
Yeah. And he never, Danny Glover looks the same, like always. Yep. It's so weird. Other than a little bit of gray in his hair, he pretty much looks the same.
Yeah.
So,
he literally points him out. They're in the police station, and Lucas Haas, who's been in a lot of films himself, points at a picture. And then I like that whole scene, the buildup of the music. And then he's like, what? And he says, I gotta call you back. And he gets up and walks over to the kid.
Yeah.
And then grabs his hand so he doesn't, no one sees him pointing.
Mm-hmm.
That's the moment when their bond is solidified.
Yeah.
And his hunch is paid off. Like, I mean, he says no one else has talked to the kid. So he picks up on that immediately for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I guess the main, which, you know, they deal with the exposition later, but at the time there's this undercover cop in a bathroom, and, the kid sees Danny Glover whip out a knife, and slice this guy's throat. And, then has a kind of a miraculous escape from the bathroom, which I think about a lot when I go in bathrooms.
Just in case you witness a murder.
Well, I mean, they do it really well, and it's come up in other movies, like, you know, the people whacking on the doors looking for somebody, and he does this duck, and like he locks the door first, and then Glover is like banging on it. Mm-hmm. And then at the moment he kicks it in, he is rolling under to the next stall, and he grabs his hat like Indiana Jones. It's great.
Yeah. I think when I watched that scene, I kept thinking about True Lies, the bathroom scene in True Lies, which is pretty awesome.
Oh, yeah.
I don't remember it.
Oh, you mean the whole fight season?
Arnold Schwarzenegger's in a stall and the other guy's kicking in the doors. You know, first he fires his machine gun across the mall, and then he goes one by one and kicks in the doors. And before he can get to the end, the one that Arnold Schwarzenegger's in, Arnold Schwarzenegger like whips open the door and dives out, and he slides across all the water on the tile, and he grabs the gun and whips up, and, you know, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not the beginning of the scene, but.
Yeah, they absolutely destroy that bathroom, by the way. There's no plumbing left at the end of it.
There's no tile or plumbing or mirrors left intact.
Right, no mirrors.
Yeah,
no
glass. It played out a little different in Witness, but... But yeah, but that's... It is a tense scene. It's well done.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think you can say that about a lot of this movie, that there's... They took a lot of care in doing a lot of things well.
Yeah.
You know? Obviously a good script. I think it got a Writers Guild Award for Best Adapted Screenplay.
I think it won an Oscar for it too.
Actually, I looked it up because I was like, this should have won the Oscar. You know what it was? What did? No. Amadeus.
Oh, for Best Picture?
Yeah, 1985 Best Picture was, I think, was Amadeus for Adapted Screenplay.
That sounds that right? About right.
No, Amadeus did win.
Yeah, but won everything. This one for original screenplay.
Oh, original. Okay.
Yeah. And editing. It was nominated for a bunch of others, picture director, actor, art direction, cinematography, and score, but it won for editing and screenplay.
You're absolutely right. It's not an adaptation at all.
Right.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah. So you guys have seen this before, right?
Yeah, back in the 1980s.
Yeah, I've probably seen it once since in the last, I don't know, maybe in the last 20 years. I don't know. I probably saw it in college again. I went through a bit of a Peter Weir phase.
You know, I was looking him up, and I've never seen The Year of Living Dangerously.
Oh, really? It's good.
Yeah. And and the cast too. It's like Mel Gibson and Sigourney Weaver. And, you know, I was like, how have I not ever seen this movie?
I think that's the one where the woman, no, wait, is that The Killing Fields? Maybe that's Killing Fields. Where a woman plays a man and won an Oscar for it. That might be The Killing Fields. Never mind.
Because having just told you I haven't seen it,
I was more or less thinking out loud.
Oh, okay.
Well, you should see it. It's very good.
All right.
All of those movies are good.
Well, that's the thing Gallipoli, Mosquito Coast, Dead Poets Society, Green Card. I mean,
Green Card. Green Card's the one of his movies I've never seen.
Oh, really?
It's the only one I haven't seen.
I think
for a romantic comedy, it's not bad.
Yeah.
I think, I think if Green Card is the first time, the first Andy McDowell movie, I'm sure she was probably in something before that, but to me, that's the first time.
She was in, St. Elmo's Fire.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah.
She's somebody's.
She has a small role. Emilio Estevez becomes very obsessed with her.
Is she part of the Riche crowd?
No.
No. Who am I thinking of? Somebody else.
I don't know.
Never mind.
Moving on. I think I never saw it because Gerard Depardieu, for some reason, irritates me. I don't know why. I got no reason. I'm not sure I've ever actually seen a movie with him in it.
Really?
No, there's no way you've not seen a movie with him in it.
There are no Depardieu.
Yeah, it's Ron DeBerjak.
I don't think I've seen it.
We could play this game, but okay. we'll all be losers. Actually, the audience, the listeners, will be losers.
The audience will be the true losers.
All right. Well, I don't know. You never were curious, like you never liked the movie Roxanne. I was like, oh, I want to see the original. Like,
no, what I mean, I know it was an adaptation of Cyrano de Bergerac. I never saw it. Never wanted to, I guess. I don't know. There's something about him I don't like. So I never, something about his face.
He has a large face with a large nose.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know.
I think it's his name. Depardieu.
Gerard. Get out of here. Anyway, what are we talking about?
We're talking about Peter Weir and how many good films he has and how many nominations. Oh, wait.
So I just looked it up. The Man in the Iron Mask. There's no way you didn't see that.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, there you go.
I didn't realize he was in it, though.
I don't even know what he plays, but
I don't either. I did see that movie, though.
Yeah, do you guys... You think you saw it on VHS or something?
Yeah, I definitely saw it way back when it first came out on VHS because I think my perspective of watching the movie and my appreciation of it was totally different than that, especially the awkward nude scene, which I think at the age of probably 13 or whatever, I was just excited that someone was on film without their shirt on. And at this point, this scene's kind of disturbing. It's like, it didn't sit with me this time. I was like, it's not right.
Yeah.
See, I don't know how old I would have been, 12 or whatever, but I was at the age where I didn't want to see, because I was usually watching this with my parents and I'm
right.
There have been a couple movies like Trading Places. We went and saw in the theater. And when we got out of the theater, I remember my dad turning to us and just apologizing to us for all the nudity. He never really said what we were apologizing for, but I liked it.
I had the unfortunately bad luck of renting, Revenge of the Nerds. Because then this is the weirdest thing. My parents would never let me watch R-rated movies when we were kids. For the most part, they'd make exceptions here and there. But the videotape, the tape box, you know, that was on the shelf in the video store had a typo on it and listed as PG. And so we rented it and I was all excited. I was like, oh, Revenge of the Nerds, this could be hilarious. And Michael Thornton was over. I think it was Mike. And we're laying on the floor because remember, I don't know if you remember, our TV was mounted on the wall in my old house in Bristol.
Yeah.
And I used to always lay on the floor in front of the couch to watch movies and stuff. And Michael and I were sitting there watching. And then that friggin' scene, the scene where they put the cameras.
Panty raid.
Oh, my God. I'm just laying there and my parents are behind me and I'm frozen. And I'm just like, make it end. Oh, my God. It just kept, that felt like a 4-hour scene while we were watching that. And then it ended. I was like, oh my God, thank God. And then we watched the rest of the movie and no one said a word about it.
Oh, right. That's the general approach, is you just don't bring it up again.
Oh, it was excruciating.
The worst one I can think of, Clan of the Cave Bear. Do you guys remember Clan of the Cave Bear?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I remember that.
The rape scene. It's horrible, but it's like, you know, it's titillating when you're a young man.
Right.
But yeah, it's really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, I bring up my parents and my dad specifically because I am going to dedicate this review to my dad, Brian, because of the many reasons. The main thing is he loves the Amish.
He loves the Amish.
He does. This is not a joke. I mean, you know, it goes, you know, he loves agrarian stuff. He lives on a farm right now. I texted him, which is a
farm in Richmond Center.
No, they live on one near Monroe somewhere out there. But yeah, at this time, 85, we had the farm in Richland Center and
with no electricity, right?
No, we had electricity.
Electricity? Or no, it had what? There was something.
Well,
what
it
was
had,
the, oh,
had
no, hot water. Setting. That's what it was.
Had well, had, well, yeah. If the pipes froze, you know, it was very rustic. But yeah, I mean, basically, I don't know if you guys remember this, but he would take me out of school, and we would go to Indiana and go to horse auctions. This was our big father-son trip. Was we drove to Shipshawana, Indiana, and stayed at a bed and breakfast, and would go to the horse auction to check out horses. Never actually bid or bought one, by the way, but we knew a lot about those horses. Actually, it was great. As a kid, you just run around all these giant barns, and there, yeah, there's just everyone is wearing a hat. They're all Amish.
How many times did you go with actual hopes that you were going to come back with a horse? Like, I'd imagine as a little kid, like, you're like, no. I'm going to a horse auction. And then you go there and you're like, we didn't buy a horse.
No. It was quite the opposite. It was, and to this day, I am still like the buffer between a snap decision and, you know, maybe we should think this over kind of thing.
You mean between you and him or you and anyone?
No, me and him, although I can't take credit for it that time. I mean, I was, you know, as a kid, but you know, yeah, I think I think my mom would have probably just said, oh, don't come back with any horses, you know, like, ha ha, I'm serious. But yeah, getting back to the movie, we watched it together. I texted him to see if he had any other thoughts. I was like, hey, you know, you know a lot of German now. Can you like translate most of the movies? Like, I kind of remember the funeral in the beginning, but he couldn't remember if we saw it in the theater, but I think we did. I have this feeling like we did it could be because it's a cinematic movie. I mean,
yeah,
the director of photography, what's his, John Beale, is that right? Cinematographer.
I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I looked it up because I was like, it's pretty beautiful film.
Yeah.
So it seems like I felt like I saw it on the big screen, but I've probably seen it three times overall, or maybe four now, and enjoyed it.
I don't remember when I saw it for the first time, but I do remember that I was not terribly impressed with it because I would have been, you know, how old were we? 1985, 11, yeah. 12, 13 years old. And to me, Harrison Ford was Indiana Jones and Han Solo. So this would have been one of the first things I probably ever saw Harrison Ford in that wasn't Star Wars or Indiana Jones.
Absolutely. And
going into it, having probably not knowing really much about it, just hoping that he'd be playing this, you know, lovable ruffian rogue type. And then, which he kind of does, I guess, but only in the context of, you know, the film. So I don't think I liked it much the first time I saw it. I'm sure I rewatched it later, probably in college. And, you know, and found an appreciation for it then.
Yeah. I mean,
I do like it a lot. It's a very good movie.
This character's name is really on the nose. You know, he's John by the book.
Yeah.
You know, his sister says he's, you know, we get that little translation from Kelly McGillis's character. And she's like, well, she said that what did she say? Well, I can't remember that whole scene. She describes him in like three sentences and nails his character. But part of it was being by the book, being a good cop and not most cops not knowing something about a bag of elbows or something. What was that line? Do you remember that?
No, I remember she said it, but I don't remember specifically what it was.
Yeah. But I mean, there's a lot of different ways in which you realize he's a little naive, but he's he's a Boy Scout, good person, good cop, mm-hmm. And stubborn as hell and dogged.
Mm-hmm.
So
the DP is John Seal. Looked it up. I mean, he shot The English Patient, which I've never seen, but I know it looks pretty great.
Gorillas in the Mist. You've never seen that.
No.
It's a tough one to watch.
I tried to watch it once and I made it like 15 minutes and I was like, no.
It's pretty long, isn't it?
I don't know. I'm sure. There are some movies that I know they're probably good. They win awards and shit. And I'm like, I'm never watching that. I'm just never gonna sit and watch that,
babe.
Well, I mean, you guys forced me to. Otherwise, I wouldn't have.
Right.
You know, the most recent thing I can think of is when Roma came out and won all the awards and everything. You remember that Roma, movie?
Yeah, yes. I haven't seen it.
I haven't either. I never will. Like, I know I'm never going to sit down and watch that. If it's free and I've got nothing else to do, I'm like, no.
Who's that? Pedro Almodóvar?
Yeah. Right. Was it him?
Yeah, it's pretty recent.
That was like 2 years ago.
No, it was Alfonso Cuarón. But yeah, I'm not gonna watch it. I mean, if we're being brutally honest, I'd probably rather watch something like Waterworld again than watch Roma ever.
Oh. We've gone a lot of episodes without a Waterworld reference.
I know.
It was nice.
It was nice.
It was a good run, but it just ended. Yeah. Oh, well.
Oh, man. Yeah. Any other quick impressions?
The one thing that sticks out to me about it, well, I mean, there's lots of things, but one thing in particular is how anticlimactic the ending is, but also how kind of perfect it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not an exciting ending. It's not the sort of ending that we're used to probably in this sort of movie. And, you know, most endings are always end up with the main bad guy and the main good guy fighting at the end. Mm-hmm. Right. There's some sort of, I mean, even if it's totally bananas, you know, like that old fucker in Roadhouse fighting with Patrick Swayze at the end. I'm like, what the hell?
Yeah. That was
so this is nothing like that. This is, you know, he comes down to the captain, who's the bad guy, the old guy, and Harrison Ford, and the old guy has the drop on him. But then all the other Amish from around, you know, the region or area, you know, come wandering over because the kid rang the bell. And then Harrison Ford's like, what are you going to do? Kill us all? And of course, he's like, what is he going to do? There's nothing to be done. He can't win. And it's simply because there's 100 Amish people standing there watching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that has been done in other movies, but not as believably.
Right. And it's not terribly exciting, but it felt very real.
Yeah.
Yeah, now, I guess you could argue that, you know, the whole last 20 minutes before that were all pretty a little action packed and exciting. And, you know, as he's running around the farm, dispensing with the bad guys.
Right.
So my memory of dispensing of Fergie in the rain, I mean, grain silo, corn silo was that it happened much faster. And yeah. Watching it now, it almost seemed like the guy getting run over by the steamroller in Austin Powers. Like, no, it just was like
move,
right? it's just like, why can't the guy get out of there? You know, why can't he do? Like, why is he pulling his shirt up over his face and just you know, crawling on top as the stuff accumulates? Like, I remember loving the idea of, like, oh, he got rid of a bad guy using, you know, dumping all the grain on him. And then this time I was just like, what? This is way too slow.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Did you guys recognize that actor?
Oh, yes. Well, mm-hmm. Yes.
What did you recognize him from?
Well, okay. So first I looked at him. I was like, is that Tager? And I was like, and when I first saw a glimpse of him, I'm like, is that Tager from Beverly Hills? And then I was like, no, it's not Tager. And then I was like,
President Ford.
Wait a second. he's Gold Leader.
Yeah.
Oh, is he?
That's not how I recognize him first, though.
Holy crap.
Yeah, he's Gold Leader. But he's also plays Rosie in Strange Brew.
Yeah.
Oh man, as soon as you said that, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah. He looks exactly the same.
He does. I should have got that.
Yeah. And I had to look it up to confirm it, though, because it wasn't, I saw him and I said, wow, that looks just like the dude who played Rosie. It wasn't like I knew.
Yeah.
Because I haven't seen Strange Brew in quite some time.
Yeah, put some hockey skates and play that hip, you know.
Like, put him in a robe.
Yeah, in a robe. There you go.
Oh. He did get to reprise his role in Rogue One. as the voice of Gold Leader just a few years ago.
Jeez, he's a freaking superstar.
Yeah. There was did you guys see Viggo Mortensen in there as an Amish person?
Oh yeah. I thought this movie was worth watching just because of that. You see like how young he is and his goofy face. Yeah.
I know, he looks like a teenager. He's so young.
Yeah. He has like one line in the
beginning. Did he have a line?
He had a line right in the beginning when they told a joke about the horse getting stung by a bee.
Oh,
I don't even know what he says, but
this is his first credited role.
But going back to the comedy, that was the punchline of the joke was who's the blonde dude from Die Hard? Who's the
I don't know.
Another cameo. But he's like, one good ball, that's all you need. I mean, it's funny, but this is the economy of words here. True. Like, well, yeah, true. No, like it's a great setup for the character we don't know, which is old Lap, Jakob Lap, who's dead. And we don't know anything about him except for what people say. And that's the first thing we hear is about how he tried to sell somebody's dad a bum horse with the bee sting and the balls.
Right.
So it paints a picture. It's like, oh, I mean, he's dead. We don't want to talk ill of him, but we kind of are.
Alexander Goodenough is the actor, the blonde actor from Die Hard.
Yeah.
Who played the Amish suitor.
Yeah.
I didn't know he died. Oh, he died a long time ago, 95.
Wow. No wonder why I haven't seen him anything recently.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
He was a Russian ballet dancer from the same class as Mikhail Bryshtikov.
Gotcha.
Well.
So we've already discussed this a little bit by text, but Cohen, do you want to talk about the double up or the overlap of another?
Oh, so episode? Yeah, you guys knew it automatically. I did not. I had to look it up, and it's the janitor, right?
Yeah.
As soon as which is, what is his name? Robert Earl Jones.
Robert Earl Jones.
James Earl Jones' father, who was also in a movie reviewed some time back, Sleepaway Camp, a much, much better film than this friggin' Witness. Oh, God. I'm kidding. Such a, Or am I?
I think this will be the last time that we actually have an overlap with Sleepaway Camp.
Yeah. You think so?
Yeah, I don't think anyone in that movie has done anything else that will possibly overlap.
There's the one kid who played the would-be boyfriend. He had a couple of movies that weren't bad. I could see myself picking at some point.
Well, only because of that.
No, not necessarily. Have you guys seen The Manhattan Project? That's a pretty good movie.
Yeah. When you mentioned it, when we did Sleepaway Camp, I've definitely seen that.
All right, yeah. So we might get there. You never know.
We might get there. And I think we'll just leave that little double up for listeners to find for themselves because it's quick and it's early. It's also there's also a lot of you talked about the end and like the kind of how the shooting goes. Like I love the realism of the violence and like the gunfight in the very first, you know, where it comes to a head pretty quickly.
Yeah.
He goes to the captain, says, "Oh, it's McPhee." And the captain's like, "McPhee, huh?" And then the next scene, Danny Glover is coming to kill him.
Yeah.
Which is awesome because and the whole scene itself is pretty, I mean, just like I was looking at the shot of the top of the car.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of moves and so you know someone is watching the basement. You see him drive in. There's other people walk into the elevator and then he goes to the elevator. Then he sees a reflection in the elevator.
Yeah.
Instinctively knows, uh-oh, here he comes. Mm-hmm. And I mean, do you have any other descriptions of that?
No, I mean, that's great. And I always what I also like is you're right. They get right to it. And of course, Harrison Ford is shot. He doesn't realize it.
Right.
Which was pretty cool. And then he looks down and sees he's bleeding and then he sits. But I like it I don't know if it's it might not be the next scene, but it's pretty close on the heels of that when he calls his partner, and basically the one thing he says is, yeah, you know, the captain's in on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, watch your back, the captain's in on it. And then he hangs up. There's no waffling or like hand wringing about it. There's no, I don't believe it, I'm going to go, you know, figure this out. None of that shit. It's like, no one else knew it was him.
He's like James Caan in Thief. He's like, boop, I'm out of here.
Yep. Yep. You know, I like that about it.
Yeah. And he asked his partner to destroy the records, which was pretty smart.
Yeah.
And his partner does it. His partner gets a shit deal in this whole thing. But
yeah.
starting with being called Stumpig, which means runt.
Oh, that guy. I also recognized him, the partner.
He looks familiar.
He was the sort of the man above the bad guy or behind the bad guy in Another 48 Hours.
Mm.
And his character is referred to as someone in the first 48 hours, but he wasn't actually in it. He was just spoken about. And then in Another 48 Hours, he's revealed. Yeah. And like the biker shoots his ear off. Whatever. Right, anyway.
Cool.
So other than Another 48 Hours guy and Robert Earl Jones and Viggo Mortensen, actually, is there anyone else? Any other little Easter egg actors or actresses in this?
So I don't know if it's really an Easter egg, but because he's not that famous. But Joseph Sommer, who is Schaefer, the bad police lieutenant,
mm-hmm.
Has 0 to 1 degree of separation from pretty much anyone we could possibly review during. The guy has been in everything. And it's one of those things where you're like, I saw his face, I recognized it. I'm like, yeah, what do I know him from? And I couldn't think of any one thing I knew him from. So I had to look him up. And he's been in like everything. And you know, just like, I was like, oh, the Mighty Ducks. Like he goes in Emilio Estevez, which we mentioned previously as someone who won't, because we keep coming up across with Young Guns or other movies. It's like, mm-hmm. like it's just, Every direction he's been in. It's like he has over 100 acting credits. He's been in Daryl, which is one of those movies that I'm sure one of these days will.
Daryl.
Yes.
Do you guys remember what it stands for?
No.
Go for Data it. Analyzing Robot Youth Life Form. Boom. From my brain. Yes.
Nice.
All right.
Don't even ask me why the hell I remember that.
Yeah, it's great. He was an Iceman, which was his role right before Witness. He was the narrator for Sophie's Choice. It's just like Reds. It's like Robert, you know, he's in that. So like all these super famous people that he's been right next to.
Yeah.
Over and over and over.
I gotta imagine he's like that. Go ahead.
Well, just that he's like a poor man, Gene Hackman, but yeah. I don't think that's given him enough credit because he's pretty good.
Yeah. Huh. I was going to say, it seems like if I were to be an actor, like a film actor, that career seems like a pretty good way to go, you know, whether by choice or otherwise, or just by circumstance. He's a guy who's a consistently working actor, probably his entire adult life. He probably makes a really good living. He's in a shitload of stuff. And, you know, real roles. He's not just some background guy. And no one probably recognizes him ever. Or if they do, they're like, why do I know that guy? Why does he look familiar? Like on the street.
This is the introvert's dream come true acting job. Yeah.
You know, you get to be in all these movies, but
there's
no paparazzi. There's no one bothering you. You can go to the store. You can go have a drink at a bar. You can go out to dinner. And no one, you know, gives you a second look. It's got to be nice.
Yeah. I confused myself looking at his Wikipedia because it said he's of German descent. I'm like, oh, this has got to be the dad. I don't know how I crossed my signals, but the guy that plays the dad, the Lap, whatever his name is.
Yeah. Eli?
Is it Eli?
Is
Eli.
It?
Yeah.
Yeah, old Eli Lap. He's actually Czech Canadian, but he does a really good version of, you know, a pseudo German Amish character. I mean,
yeah. I recognize him too from stuff, but I couldn't pick out anything.
I just looked him up. D2, the Mighty Ducks. And well, Witness.
I don't think I've ever seen any of the Mighty Ducks movies.
Yeah, I saw the first one, pretty sure.
All right, well, we know what our next pick is.
Emilio Estevez, right?
It's tempting.
We got to pick something with him.
Yeah.
I feel like he's invading on our podcast.
What did you guys think of Kelly McGillis's version of an Amish widow?
It's good. Did she have an accent? At times I thought she did, and other times I thought she didn't.
It didn't seem too much. I don't know. I mean, she was pretty quiet for a lot of the movie.
Yeah, she didn't have a ton of lines.
Yeah, it came almost as a little surprise that she was somehow a defiant and didn't care when her dad was telling her that, you know, if she sticks around with Harrison Ford, she's creating rumors.
Yeah.
You know, it almost.
Yeah, she has an oh snap moment. Do you remember that?
Right. Yeah. And it was a little bit of a surprise because there was no real hint of that before.
There's no tension, and suddenly there's a lot of tension.
Yeah.
So I guess maybe that's what makes it an oh snap moment.
Yeah. Well, she said, because he's like, you shame the family. And she's like, you shame yourself.
Yeah. I really like that line, though. I want to use that if I can ever.
Because it doesn't sound bad, but man, you could like, oh, you know, even he was like, guy had he was taken back for a moment. Like, what did you just say?
Yeah.
I think, it was pretty passable. I think it was pretty good. I think Lucas Haas was pretty good, except for, well, no, he's great. He was really good.
Yeah.
There's a moment when I think is at the end. I think he's like, you know, run to the next farm. He's like, run to the next farm and don't come back. And he says something like, John Book, you don't have your gun. And he says it like that, like all kind of somber and sweet. And instead of like, you don't have your gun. but yeah, I mean.
Yeah, that the movie really built up that gun. And the whole time you're expecting like, oh, that kid or someone's going to pull out that gun who's Amish and use it. And they never did. Like, it just felt like it was like this, like, oh, it's building up to that. It's building up to that. And then it totally fizzled out.
Yeah, it was a device that wasn't really about being a gun, almost. It was, you know, Eli sits down with Samuel and has this conversation about taking a life and it's not our way. And then, like, the way she holds it, she gets it out of the cupboard and gets the bullets out of the flower. And she's like, you know, got two fingers like it's a piece of garbage or something or a diaper.
Yeah.
Right. So.
No, they did a really good job of creating these two separate worlds, and even though they're overlapping, I'm keeping them separate. And it's you know, you're going back to how you said that the ending of the movie is, you know, in just about any movie would be a fist fight to the death or whatever. And this was just more like, hey, we didn't use your gun to save you, and it's just our solidarity that does it. And it just really drives home like the differences. I mean, I think that's one of the strengths of this movie is that you go from like gritty, grimy, and often dark Philadelphia to this bright pastoral setting.
Yeah.
And it's peaceful. And then they cut back and it's Danny Glover trying to kill someone. They cut back and then they're building a barn in the yard. You know, it's just, like really, also, really great juxtaposition of two different worlds. Consistent the whole way through.
The scene where they roll into town and those douchebags are fucking with them with the ice cream cone, and Harrison Ford has just found out that his partner was killed, and he basically takes it out on them. That was also a good sort of, you know, showing the clashing of ideals.
Yeah,
you know,
and again a dual purpose, because that was the key, that the clue that they needed to find them. Because the old guy in the bow tie is like, never seen that in all my years. And then he says, that's all. I think he's with old Eli Lapp. And then that's all I need.
Yeah.
But right before then, they walk into town and all the tourists are getting off the bus. And he's like, well, some of them don't like to taking their pictures. And then he says, lady, if you don't put that camera away, I'm going to take your brassiere off and strangle you with it. And then she's like, did you hear what that Amish person just said to me? But I'm not sure whether or not like that is directly related to the dudes. It seems like not really.
No, not really. Yeah.
No,
I don't think so.
But yeah, then he gets the phone call and then he's just simmering because like, he realizes how bad it actually is. And
yeah.
Did you guys recognize that old lady who when?
No.
She is in another Danny Glover movie.
Do tell.
Predator 2.
She's in Predator 2.
Yeah, she's in a bunch of movies. She's also she's also in The Wrestler. She's in Man on a Ledge. Yeah, she's been in a lot of stuff. And Analyze That. She's Aunt Esther.
Wow, I should recognize her.
Right. So yeah, I saw her and I was like, she's her voice. It was her voice that stuck out. That I was like, I gotta look her up. But yeah, she's someone named Ruth in Predator 2.
The woman who plays his sister, Patti LuPone.
Yeah.
Sam, my wife, she watched this with me. She recognized her right away. And I still don't really know who she is. Like, I looked her up and she's in a ton of stuff. Things I've seen. And I still don't really remember her in any of them. And I guess she's a big Broadway person, too.
Oh. I'm trying to do it from memory. I'm blanking. Mm-hmm. Patti LuPone. Do you remember anything she's in?
She's in, like, most recently, she's in a lot of TV stuff. She was in Pose, which I didn't see.
She was in Frasier.
She was in Penny Dreadful, which I did see. Don't remember. American Horror Story. Don't remember. She was in 30 Rock a few episodes. Hmm. Ugly Betty, Will and Grace. Oz. She was in Heist.
She's been on The Simpsons and BoJack Horseman.
Yeah. She was in Summer of Sam. I don't remember her in any of this. She's in 1941.
Oh man, she needs an Academy Award so she can be an EGOT.
Yeah. Does she have the other ones?
She has 2 Grammys, 2 Tonys, 2 Olivier Awards. What am I missing?
Emmy.
Oscar. Emmy. She needs an Emmy. With all that TV, she must have been close to an Emmy.
Yeah.
All I thought about that whole part, I mean, other than him being a dick for just busting in on his sister and throwing all these people at her. And she's like, I got company. And he's like, you got a man with the kids and all that.
Yeah.
But like they said, they are saying their prayers going to bed. And I was like, oh, holy shit. I had that Garfield pillowcase, that same one. So yeah, it's fun to get distracted sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Just to backtrack a little, when Sammy said you hadn't seen A Year of Living Dangerously, in that movie, the actress named Linda Hunt, who you would recognize, she's short and she was the principal in Kindergarten Cop. I don't know. Anyway, she won an Academy Award for A Year of Living Dangerously, where she played in the movie an Indonesian man. She played a male character. There was no, like, it wasn't like a transgender thing. They cast her in a male role because she looked, I don't know, short and Indonesian, I guess.
Holy crap. I got to watch that again.
It's a really good movie. It's really good. I recommend it.
That's kind of crazy. I wonder.
That's basically blackface.
Right.
I don't know about that.
But you got to be like, no one would do that these days. No one would be like,
right.
Hey, that's like. I don't know.
We can critique the, you know, the 2020 viewing of this movie, but the main thing that that stuck out these days is Samuel Lapp kind of pressing his face against the window on the Amtrak train, and then playing with the drinking fountain, like, kid, oh, germs, yeah. Come on.
I know. It's the same thing.
Gross. Stupid kid. I thought, you know, the whole time I was watching Witness, I thought, I was trying to remember when American Tail came out, and like, why the hell does he look just like Fievel? Seriously, they look like
because he has like the ears of a mouse. Yeah.
Like they base Fievel on Lucas Haas and Witness. I mean, my memory's a bit hazy, but in my mind, I picture a mouse that basically looks just like he did in Witness, with the hat and everything.
Pretty much right. Yeah. That's cool. Of your Lucas Haas bashing.
Bashing.
That's. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say, you know, some of the things we usually cover, I don't know if you guys went back and read any of the original reviews, but Vincent Canby of the New York Times was one of the few people who didn't think highly of this movie. And his quote in his review was, "It's not really awful, but it's not much fun."
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not, he's not wrong. It's not fun. That's just not the kind of movie it is.
Yeah, it's serious.
Jeez, that's an unfair criticism.
It's a good rating. It's like a 90-something, low 90% on Rotten Tomatoes. And the film was a success. I think was made for $12 million and made about $70 million. So even now on Rotten Tomatoes, the fan reviews in the about around 80%. So apparently it holds up.
Mm-hmm. Oh, tangentially related, speaking of Lucas Haas, there's, I don't know if you guys have seen, but there's a new version of Amazing Stories on Apple TV, Apple Plus, the streaming service.
Used to be Spielberg?
Yeah. So there's a new version. I think he's actually still the executive producer. I watched the first episode. It was decent. But then I went back and watched the very first episode of the original series, which was okay. And the train is about a train.
Damn it.
And Lucas Haas was in it.
Oh. The theme.
Yeah.
I just remember the plane trying to land and not having any landing gear.
Mm-hmm.
And was that episode 2 or 3 or something?
I don't remember, but I know what you're talking about. I've seen it where he draws it on or something, yeah. Right? And animates.
Yeah.
Yeah. I used to love that show. That was awesome.
I can't remember it.
Sam, my wife asked me she just said, "Whoa, what's Amazing Stories?" I said, "Well, it's like Twilight Zone, but way happier."
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like generally had a fairly happy ending or not too dark, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like Twilight Zone with happy endings.
Which could be a good thing. And if your conceit is good, I don't know about drawing wheels on a plane, but.
I don't remember. I would probably, if I watched all the Amazing Stories episodes, I would remember them as I watched them. But right now I couldn't tell you, other than the one I watched and the one we're talking about, I couldn't tell you any of the other episodes.
Yeah. Getting back to Witness, I don't think Witness could be made in the world of cell phones because, I appreciated this.
Well, maybe.
Well, but because the Amish not having phones is a big part of why he's unreachable.
Yeah, but if they wouldn't have cell phones either.
But if he had a cell phone, they would have just found him. They would have just tracked.
Well, he'd have destroyed it.
Yeah,
he'd have got rid of it,
not that dumb.
No, but the Amish he was with might have. I mean, it just works really well in.
It does. You're right. Time. It does. It works. It works better. I mean, there's a lot of movies that are like that. That if it takes place in 2020, it's over in 10 minutes, or it never happens at all.
Like when he calls Schaefer bad guy, and he's like, "Oh, real calling me at home, real smart, John. Can't trace the call."
No. Right.
I was like, really? You can't? That's all you can do is just kind of tell him, touche, you got me. But I guess that's probably true. He didn't have the equipment. It's not official.
But that's why Stranger Things has to be set in the 80s. Because the episodes of Stranger Things, every single one of them depends on them not communicating with each other. Like, if you go back and watch it, you're like, oh, if they just had cell phones, they'd be like, hey, I'm at such and such and this freaky monster's here.
Right. You know? Right. And the internet, I mean, social media, like right. people, you know, pick up on these things immediately now.
So, yeah, you're right. You couldn't remake this movie in modern day. It wouldn't be worth it. And the other thing, if it did, like, I think that there'd probably, I don't think they could make the Amish community as nice it is, because there have been some pretty bad stories in the last few years, kind of along the lines of Catholic Church bad stories.
Oh, yeah.
About how that community is.
So Amy, I don't think that too.
Yeah, you couldn't remake this movie and be and somehow ignore that. Like, I think that would probably raise some eyebrows in itself.
True.
Well, I was just going to say, this movie's best back where it was made and not being touched.
Yeah, agreed.
Part of, like, Kelly McGillis not having a subdued version of her character is because that's, you know, that's part of the society that she's in. Not good, obviously. I mean, not good from a equality standpoint, but that's very true. Is that, I mean, they don't, there's no, you guys know what Rumspringa is? Mm-hmm. There's 16 Amish kids. Yeah. They have this get out of jail free card.
Sure.
They kind of ignore that, but yeah, there's some interesting documentaries on people that, you know, like what they decide. They have got one chance at it, you know, they get, I don't know how long, but you know, they turn 16, ignore all of the rules, drink, party, do whatever you want. And then you have to either come back and be done with all of that, or you just reject the entire community.
Right.
It's really harsh.
Well, they talk about, I mean, they sort of allude to it in the movie a little bit when they're going to Baltimore to see her sister.
Right.
Clearly she lives there, right? Because they're going to visit on a train and it's a ways away. And
yeah. Again, oh, you mean you think that she's out in the society or something?
Yeah, yeah.
I thought so too, but I looked it up, and Baltimore or Maryland has an Amish community. They're all descendants of the Pennsylvania Dutch community in Lancaster County.
Hmm.
So I just believe, but that's the first thing I thought. It's like, Baltimore? What the hell is she going to Baltimore for?
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, so maybe she just lived in a different Amish community and Baltimore's the nearest city to get a train to.
Yeah, but because they never get anywhere closer than Philadelphia, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
And that's another plausible reason that, like, you think, oh, yeah, maybe her sister is out of the community. Well, she obviously is out of the community, but.
Yeah, but she might be a part of another one.
Married into another one, yeah.
Did you guys notice anything about the score?
Oh, yes. Tina and Dallas will be happy to know I paid close attention to the soundtrack.
Yeah. What did you think of it?
Well, I mean, first of all, I had to look up who it was. I mean, it definitely has like a Tangerine Dream 80s keyboard feel, which works and which doesn't. Why don't you guys give me your impressions of it?
Well, yeah. I mean, the first thing I noticed, obviously, is that it's just this heavy synthesizer 80s feel to it. Right now, the only thing that comes to mind, like you said, Tangerine Dream, and, you know, like the Warriors had a similar sort of score. But also, you know, when Drive came out with Ryan Gosling, I think it was intentional that the score was a reflection, you know, sort of an emulation or an homage to the sort of 80s synth scores that have sort of come back into style again.
Yeah.
In the last 10 years, you know, in the 2000s and up till now. But that I looked up, I didn't know who Maurice Jarre was either. Or Jar, I don't know how you say it. But
it's French, so it's probably Jar.
So he scored a lot of movies and big ones, like all of David Lean's movies, which is crazy because most of those do not have any sort of synth score, if I remember correctly. It's a thing about him said he, in the 80s, in the mid 80s, early to mid 80s around Witness, he started to switch from orchestral to synthesized, which is weird. But I mean, it was the 80s. So I guess he was sort of following the times. But well, Sam, my wife didn't like the score at all. It actually distracted her from the movie completely.
Oh, the beginning, I think, is terrible. It sounds like we were in grade school and they were putting on those old film projector things, like the teacher has to flip the the film projector along with the music on the record or whatever. And it's, yeah, I was like, I thought this is a middle of the 1980s movie, and it sounds like kind of mid to late 70s score.
Yeah.
I found it distracting. And once the movie started, it was fine. But
I didn't mind it, except for the scene where he sees her naked. And it's just it was really distracting then, because it's such a quiet moment.
I don't remember the music in that moment.
Then maybe I'm thinking of the wrong scene.
You're thinking of their big coming together. There's that's very she, it's after this. So let's, in chronology, there's the sponge bath moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then next morning he goes, you know, Rachel, if we had made love, I would I couldn't leave, or you'd have to. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
And then she is the one who, she takes off her hat, her unadorned head, her English looking head, you know, whatever. Uh-huh. It's a, you know, they focus on it maybe a little too much, but then she goes out to him and they, you know, they're out in the grass and they have.
Oh, yeah.
That's the moment.
Yes. That's
wind is whipping around. And
And the music is just like, holy God.
Way too much.
Just totally undercuts the effectiveness. Like, the emotional core is destroyed in that scene because of the weird music. The rest of it didn't really bother me too much. I didn't notice it after a while, but that scene was like kind of being slapped in the face.
It stands out for sure. It's subtle for a little while. And then, you know, they're only making out for, you know, it's like a 10-second moment. But, you know, as soon as he like goes for her neck, like starts nibbling on her neck, it turns all melodramatic and minor key. Like, oh, no, you know, you know, so you can just see him at the keyboard as he's like scoring this, you know, because I almost felt like, because he's been in the game a long time, like an older throwback to an older time when you had to kind of do that to denote, you know, kind of a sinister motive here. Like, oh, things are getting, this is a little hanky panky here. This is not good.
Yeah.
You know? Because Amy was like, did they do it? I can't remember the end. And I'm like, well,
no. I don't know.
No,
and make out and they don't really. Yeah. I think you're right.
I think that's his whole point, is that if they took the relationship anywhere, one of them would have to leave their world, and he's not willing to leave his, and she's not going to leave hers.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I described that as an emotional surrender for the kids, you know, to keep it. Never mind.
I do like looking at this composer's track record here. And I love the idea that someone could go from doing the movie Top Secret to Dreamscape to Witness to Mad Max to Enemy Mine. I mean, that's like,
and then but also all of David Lean's movies,
yeah,
which are crazy. That's like that's funny. Yeah, that's a pretty that's a broad spectrum he's got.
What was the music like in Fatal Attraction?
Fatal Attraction
probably the same. Yeah.
Yeah, but we got to give him credit because he did all these, like you said, he did all these Lawrence of Arabia strings, whatnot. Mm-hmm. And he he's listed as kind of a pioneer of the synthesizer in movie making. So, you know, obviously this is early days, hit and miss. but the most interesting thing I picked up on was he married an actress, another famous actress, and his son, who took his adopted name, was Kevin Jarr.
Yeah.
And he's a famous screenwriter. He did Glory, among other things, but I've never thought that I'd pay attention to that last name and actually have it match up with somebody that I heard of, but
yeah.
Random. He did other stuff too, but I can't think of it. In Glory, he's the soldier that starts the fight with the 54th Regiment.
Yeah. He also wrote Tombstone.
Yeah, Tombstone, thanks. Which is crazy. Oh, he was supposed to direct Tombstone, and then he got kicked out of it.
Whoops.
And then gave it to George Cosmatos, apparently.
Hmm.
Tombstone comes around again.
Yeah.
So where'd you guys watch Witness?
Tubi.
Yep.
With commercials, free with commercials.
All right. What age do you think you could watch this?
With or without your parents?
Yeah. With your parents, without your parents. Somewhere, I mean, this is something like 12 or 13 year old, no problem.
Yeah, like PG-13, yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't know that this is the only movie Harrison Ford has ever nominated for an acting Oscar, for an Oscar. He's never been nominated for anything else.
Yeah, you mean to tell me in Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull didn't get him?
I thought it was great in Regarding Henry.
Sure. But, I mean, he's good to everything. He's Harrison Ford, but it's odd that...
I mean, as an Oscar vehicle, I thought that would have worked as well.
Yeah, well, I'm sure he did too.
That's crazy. I'd have thought that, yeah, Mosquito Coast was another one that he might have been nominated for.
Yeah. Trying to think of other Harrison Ford movies that are the sort of movies that you might be nominated for an Oscar for.
Mm.
Oof. What about Air Force One? Come on.
Right.
The Fugitive. That's it. That's what I was trying to think of. The Fugitive was huge.
That was huge.
Yeah, but it's an action movie. They weren't. Like nowadays, if you did The Fugitive, they would probably nominate because they're willing to. But back then, it was pretty much like if it wasn't a drama, it didn't get nominated.
Was that not nominated for awards? I thought it was like a big. Was it not?
I don't know.
I mean,
it's a great movie.
Provasic, and you know, it's a great movie. But it's not. I mean, it's
okay,
not a
yeah,
stretch.
It was nominated for. Supporting actor, best picture, original score, cinematography, sound mixing, film editing, sound editing. It won for supporting actor. Who the hell's T.L. Jones?
No, Tommy Lee Jones.
Who the hell's T.L. Jones?
Why'd they put T.L.?
I don't know.
Yeah, that's his like.
He won for that?
Yeah, he got, that's his, like, became super famous. Yeah,
it's bigger for him than it was for Harrison Ford.
Huh. Yeah. I guess I don't remember that.
The Fugitive for Tommy Lee Jones was what Pulp Fiction was for John Travolta.
Yeah, you think so?
Yeah.
No. Don't.
Yes.
Kind of.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a hiatus in his career, though.
Not like... Yeah, but it was definitely like a rebirth. Okay, well, we'll put it more in 1980s terms.
Because he was in Under Siege before The Fugitive, and Under Siege is a fucking masterpiece.
I was gonna say what my other analogy was gonna be what Run DMC did for Aerosmith.
Sure. I like that one.
Yeah,
that works for me. Yeah, so The Fugitive was the third highest grossing film in 1993, so it was pretty big.
Hmm. All right. Anyway, have we witnessed enough witness?
Yeah.
All right. Want to know what we're doing next?
I do.
Sure.
You want a hint of what we're doing next?
Yes.
I'll give you an actor. So there's only going to be, there's, my guess is you guys should get it within three guesses.
Okay.
Because this actor only has so many things which he's known for.
All right.
And it's that are worth watching. Mm-hmm. And the actor's Matthew Broderick.
It's Godzilla, isn't it?
I mean, I would say that Ferris Bueller's Day Off is his most watchable movie.
Well, I just mentioned Glory.
Yeah, I mean that's fine, but
that is a good movie.
It is good. So, can you give us an era like 80s, 90s, 2000s?
All right, let's go.
Because I mean, I could 90s. We could sit here and name off like all the movies. Is it election?
Okay, wait. Okay, well, yep. There you go. Yeah. Yeah.
It was about three.
Just
guesses.
Had to know the decade.
I told you three guesses. You didn't even have to. Right.
I guess it was the third, huh? Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Glory, election.
See. yeah. I mean, what else are you going to say in the 90s? I mean, I know you're going to say his small part in The Cable Guy.
That was not a small part.
Well, okay. He's not the main guy, but.
Well, he's the main after the title character.
yeah.
It's just anyway, you
almost could have guessed The Cable Guy.
Yeah.
But I haven't seen Election since I saw it in the theater.
I don't think I have either.
Yeah, so I figured that would be one to see again. Yeah. And Reese Witherspoon, I think that's her first real role. So funny to talk about.
She plays a teenager.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Just made it in on The Wire, too. It was released in 99.
Yep.
Oh, cool. Is this her first 99 movie?
Yep.
First late 90s movie, actually. I think we've done 94, 90. Six maybe.
I think we did the French movie, the City of Lost Children.
Oh yes, and Lost.
Which Children. Oh wait, no, that was 95. No, we did Fever Pitch, which was 97. That was the one that was late.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. This has been a pretty amazing review. I think probably our best one so far.
Perhaps, indeed.
Perhaps, yeah. No, I think under careful consideration, it's the best.
Yeah.
All right.
Right. Well, this has been The Film with Three Brains. Thanks for listening.
See you next time.
Adios.
And wash your hands.
It's The Film with Three Brains.
Make it end. Oh, my God.